Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Augusto Macellari and Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
On today's show, we'll be looking ahead to tonight's Grammy Awards as we meet ethnomusicologist and the Grammy's World Music Awards manager, Marlon Fuentes.
Then we'll be discussing one of New York's most important art fairs, the Armory Show, as we catch up with its executive director, Nicole Berry.
And we'll be hearing from the legendary samba musician, Seu Jorge.
That's all coming up, plus Monocle's Bill Luthi will be looking ahead to next week's news, and we'll enjoy some music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Hello, Faye. How are you?
I'm very good. I'm happy you're here for episode 501. The Monocle Weekly still stands.
It's nice, isn't it? We had the big 500 last week, and this maybe feels like a... Well, hopefully it won't feel like an anticlimax, actually, because we've got some really good guests on this week's show.
Including some Brazilian legends, Og. I was a bit jealous. You managed to interview Seu Jorge. Was he nice?
He was absolutely lovely and is bringing a welcome Brazilian flavour to this week's edition. Worth remembering as well that if you like his music, which I'm sure you will, you can always tune in to the sessions at Midori House. We got him to record a few tracks when he popped through, so anyone who's enjoying it should definitely seek those out.
It's a very musical show today. I like that.
That's the latest from Midori House. It's time now to have a little look at the week ahead. And who have we got here to do it? None other than Monocle's Bill Luthi.
Which way?
Bill, welcome.
Hi, guys. How are you doing?
We're very excited that you're here.
Yeah? I'm pretty excited to be here. Should we crack straight on with this news look ahead? So today and tomorrow is the African Union Summit taking place in Addis Ababa, which is interesting for a number of reasons that I will tell you now. Egypt, for the first time, is the chair of the group. They haven't done that before. It was only set up in 2002, so... it's not surprising, but it comes at kind of an interesting time for them. They've got quite a delicate relationship with the union, having previously been kicked out in 2013 for, well, the political issues after the Arab Spring in that country. They've said they're going to be concentrating on 6 points, which these, you know, when they have like targets they're going to reach. So they're a bit kind of wordy, but I'll read them out anyway. Building bridges among Africa's people. That sounds like a good one. Cooperation Wonderful. With partners, economic and regional integration, economic and social development, institutional and financial reform of the African Union, and peace and security. So that's quite nice, isn't it? But yeah, that's kind of what Egypt is pushing from their perspective. That's what they're interested in. But there's so much going on across the continent that other countries are kind of going to be pushing other ways. So, for example, Libyan crisis, there's protests all over Sudan. There's lots and lots of border disputes going on. So, you know, it's good that that Egypt want to push these kind of economic ideas, but it's sort of like there's other things to be thinking about
sure.
at the moment.
For sure. But one thing that's quite interesting leapt out at me there is that Egypt is chairing this meeting in Ethiopia's capital. Ethiopia and Egypt have, of course, had some issues in recent years. There's this huge dam being built in Ethiopia, part of a $1 billion infrastructure project that over the Nile, that Egyptians are worried is going to kind of, I guess, take the oomph out of the Nile, which sounds like the start of a joke, doesn't it? And they're worried that this dam is going to hold back the Nile, which they, for obvious reasons, view very much as theirs. So there's interesting tensions even within, you know, these sorts of who's chairing what kind of arrangements. Definitely something to watch out for.
Staying in the same area of the world, the Nigerian elections.
I love a good election.
You do, don't you?
And that's a big democracy. I mean, there's quite a lot of people in Nigeria.
Yeah, well, I was reading an interesting article about this, and apparently the elections are kind of steered by the so-called godfathers, who are basically rich, mostly men, businessmen. You know, maybe they have control over resources, kind of oil, that kind of thing. And they kind of pick a candidate from their area who they think is going to get them richer, and then they put so much money behind them that they win. And then the whole country's election is decided by these sort of mafia bosses. It's kind of fascinating.
It sounds like everywhere's elections, he said conspiratorially.
At least they have a name for it.
Yeah, good point.
Where are we going next, Bill?
Wednesday, time for a little bit of navel gazing. It's World Radio Day.
Nice.
So that's good. You know, obviously it's a day to celebrate radio around the world and get people to come together and celebrate this excellent medium. But I think it's interesting, this week Spotify bought Gimlet Media, so a huge podcasting company in the US, for $200 million, which is like so much money. And it's a refreshing sign that people think that, despite, you know, the sort of changes from what we might think is traditional radio, like BBC, etc., in this country, there's still excitement for what we do. It's great news.
It's incredibly good news. It says a lot about the kind of the corporate view on podcasts as an industry. I mean, it's extremely helpful, isn't it?
What's your first radio memory, Bill?
Listening to Breakfast Show, when I woke up, I had a little radio alarm clock, and every day, I don't know, people in different countries, this might not mean anything, but Chris Moyles just used to wake me up every morning, which is kind of weird looking back now.
Yeah, horrible to think about it now.
But then it was good. And then Thursday, it's Valentine's Day, guys. Have you got any plans?
Champagne?
On your own?
No, with my partner.
I'm going to eat all 64 oysters.
Yeah?
No, I'm going to be away.
So you'll be on your own. You'll be getting drunk on champagne.
Yes.
What about you, Bill? What are you going to do?
Well, this has reminded me I need to make some plans, so I've got to go.
Off you go. Go and get down Thornton's and get a nice heart-shaped box of Chockies. Bill Lutie, thank you so much. You're with the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Stay tuned. First up on the Monocle Weekly, it's the Grammys tonight. So in preparation for it, we're going to speak to someone who knows all about the way music consumption has changed in recent years, the role of streaming services, and how the Recording Academy, which is the group that runs the Grammys, wants to reflect those changes this year.
And that man is Marlon Fuentes, ethnomusicologist, former DJ for Shakira and now World Music Awards manager for the Grammys. Marlon, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. A pleasure talking to you. And this is your first Grammys that you're working, right, Marlon? How excited are you?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, this is going to be my first Grammy show working. And, you know, it's very exciting for me because as an ethnomusicologist, someone that has studied musics from around the world, and also as a DJ who's, you know, spent hours and hours in the club and in all sorts of different venues, you know, it's a great honor for me to be able to, you know, really celebrate music at this level.
Marlon, as we mentioned earlier, you know, the way people consume music has changed enormously over the past sort of decade or so. From albums to singles, people are listening to tracks more rather than complete works. And I wonder what your reflections are on how that shift has taken place and what it's meant for the music industry.
Yes, you know, I think one thing that's very interesting for me, you know, especially, you know, being a DJ and being somebody that has always relied on the work of tastemakers to really kind of broaden my musical horizons, I think that it's very interesting that we have a generation that's growing up with streaming services that are curating essentially mixtapes for them. And it's an opportunity for people to really dig into genres and subgenres. And what's actually very exciting about this is that instead of sort of grouping multiple different genres together into one big broad concept, such as like world music, we're able to really celebrate the different cultures and the different sounds. And you have people that are growing up that are, you know, able to tell you about cumbia and techno cumbia, or even some of the playlists that I've seen most recently that I think are very interesting. For example, I didn't know that this existed, but there's a playlist on Pago Funk from Brazil, which is, I guess, a subgenre that mixes samba pagode and baile funky, which is pretty interesting for me, right? So there's whole playlists on this kind of stuff. You also have curated hubs, for example, the Arab Hub on Spotify that has multiple Arab genres inside of this one big hub of music. So I think it's very interesting to grow up this way, where you no longer are sort of walking around a music store, you know, with very simple sort of categories in grand. You know, you have now the opportunity to really dig in. And, you know, hopefully, I think this is a trend that continues and that broadens people's horizons. I also believe that one of the things that is happening is that there's an all-time high for crossover. So you have artists that are being listened to by other audiences, and, you know, really the distances between artists is actually becoming very, very short, and you're going to start to see a lot more collaborations. That's something that I'm very excited about.
Marlon, do you think for young artists, is it better the way things are at the moment where Spotify can add your single in a playlist instead of in the past where you had to have like a label and you had to make a CD and sell in the shops? Do you think it's easier like for younger artists, or do you still think that those streaming services like Spotify, they still give much attention, you know, to the top artists of the moment?
Yes, I think that it's kind of an interesting scenario where you have more music, but also easier access to big platforms. So one of the things that the Grammys looks for is music that is nationally distributed. You know, in the past, to have your record distributed nationally, you really relied on a big company to help you get your music out. Whereas now, you know, you can be making music, you know, in your bedroom and get the attention of different groups of audiences and, you know, kind of rise in the rankings, so to speak. You know, I think that it is in one way a little bit more of an ecosystem for you to find your place in. But on the other hand, I think it creates a lot of access. And for the audiences, I think there's never been a bigger variety at hand. You know, I remember when I was, you know, 16 years old going to Tower Records Music, for example, and, you know, just kind of walking around and looking at different things. And, you know, whatever they had is what they had, you know, and there wasn't really an opportunity for me to kind of find other music, you know, that may not have been carried by the store. And so I think now you can really dig deep into the digital crates and, you know, who knows where it will lead you. But I think that there's quite a bit of music out there for people to enjoy. And I think ultimately with the right curation, I think you have a great opportunity to become a fan of, you know, something that you might not have expected.
You mentioned the right curation there. And just a moment ago, you were talking about the way that how we discover music has changed. And I was just wondering if you, as an ethnomusicologist, you know, do you trust the algorithm? You know, the Spotify algorithm that drives up music that it thinks you're going to like. For some reason, I've never been able to shake this kind of deep-seated mistrust of it. And I wondered if you think that something is lost when it's a computer recommending music based on a previous search history, as opposed to another human being, say, who knows your character, who knows what you've liked in the past, who can say, hey, do you know what? I think you're really going to like this.
Yeah, that's a very good question. You know, when it comes to technology and music and curation and recommendations, I believe in the human algorithm. There's a great British ethnomusicologist, John Blacking, who talked about people being talented listeners. And I think that's really the role of the DJ, you know, in broad terms, the role of the DJ being a talented listener. So I think that there's going to definitely be a human touch and a human perspective in the contextualization of music. But on the other hand, I think what's very important for artists is to really take metadata very seriously. That's something that's going to be very important now and in the future, because the more metadata that you have, the more contextualized the music can become, the more easier it is to find. For example, one of the things that I'm excited about, you know, being a technologist myself, is that we're going to be utilizing a lot more voice-activated technology. I was just at MIT Media Lab hacking with the new Bose AR frames, for example. And this is a device that allows you to essentially control your mobile phone with voice and with gesture and kind of listen to music as you go. One of the things that I'm excited about is just being able to kind of interface with a platform like a Spotify or like an Apple Music in a way that's voice activated. And I think the more metadata, the better and the richer and the more contextualized the music can become, the easier it will be for me to find it, right? And many, many other data points can help curate that experience. But ultimately, I do believe that humans will always be a part of this process, because at the end of the day, this is about feeling. I think, to my knowledge, only humans can do that right now.
When you're talking about the way things change as well, you know, and we're talking about metadata and the importance of it, what does that mean in practical terms for the artists? I've sort of wondered about, does taste, when it becomes so spread out on these platforms as it is, when people are accessing them and getting personalized to an extent playlists, and when artists are making music that's going to be put on this platform, presumably, you know, you were talking about hacking, and obviously it's a different thing, but there must be a temptation to try and kind of hack the playlist, to hack this system. And that, in my mind at least, seems to mean, in some way, as an artist, changing musical kind of agency, changing creativity in accordance with this sort of perceived machine necessity. And is that something that you think is going to start cropping up?
You know, I think that the approach of metadata with music, I think, is something that's going to be very important for artists. You know, to give you an example, if I say, hey, play me a James Brown song to a virtual assistant, it's not going to know exactly which one to play, right? But if there are more data points that point towards, you know, a particular contextual significance of the song for a particular time, you know, it could even be by biometrics, for example, I think that will give an artist a little bit more opportunity to sort of be at there at the right moment. With regards to metadata and these algorithms, just kind of taking a step back and thinking about the way that DJs select music. You know, DJs have this sort of engine, this sort of search engine, as they dig through their crates and they understand, oh, you know, the dance floor needs to be picked up right now. Let me find the records that are the most danceable, that have the most uplifting vibe. Or maybe, you know, this is a somber moment. This is the last song of the evening. Let me find a song that's appropriate for that. You know, I tend to play Serge Gainsbourg songs at the end of my DJ sets sometimes, because it's kind of a mellow vibe and everybody kind of cools down. But even then, there's sort of this contextualization of the music based on information that I have at hand. And so what that means for artists, I don't think it's going to be as much of a kind of hacking your way to the top of any sort of playlist. I think it's sort of reflecting the most accurate depiction of your song, and really giving, whether it's a person or whether it's an algorithm, the opportunity to discover you. You know, similar to web pages, one thing that I do hope also is that, to your point, is that these profiles match reality, right? And so one thing that search engines had to do early on in web search was to begin to create qualifiers that would actually validate, hey, this is a real web page, this is what it's about. And not only that, but this is the most accurate and this is the best information that's out there to get to the top of the rankings. You know, this is something that, you know, Google had to change, for example. But when it comes to music, I think what matters is that you have as much information into your metadata and that you kind of think about it in terms of being discovered. So just to give you a sense of some of the data points that are out there: danceability, energy, key, loudness, mode, acousticness, instrumentalness, liveliness. These are all metrics that are actually tracked by platforms like Spotify. And so if artists can begin to think about their music in this way, I think it will help them be discovered. And I would say, for the majority of times, this is really kind of helpful for people that are creating platforms or that are curating playlists and that are not so much necessarily looking for a machine to do the work, but that are looking for assistance in discovering this new music.
It's fascinating. I feel like I can see a kind of overlap between that and, I suppose, more traditional ethnomusicological work. This idea that you're simply expanding the set of categories through which you view the music, from beyond genre into, as you say, like biometric categories and things like that. It's really interesting. One of the questions that I did have, though, was at the top you were mentioning how we live in a world where this kind of incredible hyper-accelerated globalization has driven this postmodern kind of genre-busting process, and you suddenly are encountering these amazing fusions of different genres. Within that, I kind of wanted to ask where this, like, slightly anachronistic seeming label of world music sits. You know, it's such a broad brushstroke, and I wondered how useful you continue to find it.
That's a great question. World music is a collection of genres and musics from around the world. And I think the right way to think about this is to kind of consider non-Western music consumed in the United States. So the Recording Academy and the Grammy Awards celebrates the best music that is consumed domestically in the United States. The United States is a you know, country of immigrants, the United States has an amazing music scenes from around the world. For example, just living in Los Angeles, you know, I have the opportunity to go to Ethiopian festivals. I can go to Cambodian celebrations. I can go to Korean celebrations. I can go listen to mariachi. I can go to some very authentic, you know, cumbia joints. I can also go to a samba event. And so we understand that this is really an opportunity for us to sort of celebrate the best music from around the world that is being listened to in the United States, and to really celebrate sort of the international community in that sense, with a very key distinction that we are looking at music that is non-Western. And so this obviously makes way for musics from all different continents. And that's why you have such a diversity of genres. So the world music is really an opportunity to celebrate the different genres and musics of the world that are being consumed domestically here.
That was Marlon Fuentes there. And the Grammys, as we discussed, are taking place tonight. So do tune in. Now, though, stay with us. The Monaco Weekly continues after this.
Now, as we've just heard, Marlon is the World Music Awards manager for the Grammys. So what better to listen to now than something from the shortlist? Here is Fatuma Diawara with Interini.
That was Interini by Fatuma Diawara. You're listening to the Monaco Weekly on Monaco 24. This March, the Armory Show, one of New York's essential art fairs, returns to Piers 92 and 94, looking out over the Hudson River in New York. Specialising in 20th and 21st century art, this year the show celebrates its 25th annual edition and will welcome over 65,000 visitors from March the 7th to the 10th.
Earlier, Monaco Stonehall spoke to the show's executive director, Nicole Berry, about what to expect in 2019. And she began by explaining a little bit about the event's history.
The fair started 25 years ago. We're actually celebrating our 25th anniversary this year. And it started out in a hotel, the Gramercy Hotel here in New York City. It was founded by four New York City art dealers. And they started a hotel fair, and it was called the Gramercy International. And it was there for a few years, and then it became successful, and they needed a bigger venue. And they moved to the Lexington Avenue Armory, which in fact was the site of the original Armory Show in 1913. So the name changed as an homage to that event. That was when avant-garde art was introduced to America. It was where Duchamp's Nude Descending a Staircase was seen, and the critics panned it. People were aghast. But that was the art that ended up being now part of the canon of art history. So it's incredibly important to art history and to the development of art throughout the contemporary art period.
And then coming up to the present, what do people see when they're heading there for 2019?
The reason that it was named after the original Armory Show in 1913 is because it was, as it started out, it was showing very contemporary art that was being created at that time. And we still have, I would say, predominantly contemporary art at the fair now. We're showing work that's created by living artists, but we also have modern art that is peppered in throughout the fair. And so it's really nice because it gives context to the artwork that's being shown. We have everything from sculpture, video, photography, painting, large-scale projects, performance. So you can find a bit of everything at the Armory Show in 2019.
And this is your second time in charge. What kind of changes have you brought in the last, you know, year and a half?
We're on two piers that jut out into the Hudson River, so it's a lot of space. And it was branded for many years as contemporary on one pier and modern on the other. And we've really worked hard to, as I was saying, blend that so it makes more sense. There's been a shift to showing modern and contemporary in conjunction as opposed to separating them out. So that was one really big change because people people are habitual and are used to seeing year after year the same thing. And we really shook up that sort of format in order to make sure that people felt like they could see everything on both piers. And they really hadn't seen the Armory show unless they'd seen both of those areas. And then other things we've done, we've carved out a lot of space within the fair. Historically, it's been a lot of booths, and all of the fairs, you know, you're seeing a ton of art when you go. And so it became really important to have areas for pause and reflection. And we were really successful with that last year and got a ton of great feedback regarding those areas, because you're just taking in so much information. And having these large-scale works and areas where there's space to breathe, you get a moment to take in everything that you've seen, as opposed to just keeping going booth after booth.
When you're designing the space and the floor plan of an art show, from a pure sort of like cold hard cash element, does the booth system kind of serve the buyer better? Because, you know, they can dart around to their stalls and go exactly where they want to go and then get out. So I just wondered whether these layouts serve the serious buyer better, or do they serve the sort of speculative art visitor the most?
The fair is a real intersection of commerce and experience. And we understand the exhibitors are spending a lot of money to participate in our fair, and we want to provide the most beneficial platform for sales. So we're always thinking about how the collectors are going to navigate the fair, what is the best floor plan that takes all of that into consideration. Of course, we're in New York City. We're in the heart of the art capital of the world. So we have to anticipate that there will be people who will be coming who aren't going to buy anything. And that's great. They're exposed to a lot of art, and perhaps they'll become collectors in the future. But our primary focus is to create an experience that allows for those commercial sales to happen, but also to think about the experience. These collectors that are coming to buy attend probably other international art fairs. And so we want to make it unique, and we want to give them a reason to come to ours versus another one, oftentimes, or in addition to another one. But we certainly are always thinking about how the floor plan, how our projects that we're working on will be received by the dealers, the collectors, and the general public.
Approaching this year's event, it's coming up very soon. What kind of themes or, you know, ideas are going into that this year?
Well, as I mentioned, it's our 25th anniversary. So it was a very important time, especially, so this is my second year as the director, but my first from start to finish. So after last year's fair, I began thinking about this one. And it was a great time to revisit, look back a bit, and do some research on why the fair was created and its entire history, because I feel that it's important to look back, to look forward, and to move forward. So we are paying tribute to the founders of the fair while also doing things like creating a prize where a young gallery that was nominated by people that were affiliated with the early years of the fair and are still attendees of the fair selected a young gallery to be the beneficiary of a free booth. And that prize is called the Gramercy International Prize, which is obviously a tribute to the original name of the fair and the early years of the fair in the spirit of that fair and the community that it built. And so that will be something that we initiate this year, but will be something that will continue on with the fair moving forward.
At what point do you really start kicking into gear for planning the event? Is it 11 months ago? Is it 6 months ago? Where do things start to really get serious?
My partner has the perfect response to this. He says, you know, Nicole is really only busy the 6 months leading up to the fair and the 6 months after the fair. But other than that, she's totally available. Sometimes I wish I had 2 years to plan it. It's funny because people who don't know the scope of it might say, it takes you a year to plan, but it really does if you're going to do it right. And this is the only, we're not a franchise, so this is the only fair that we produce. So we better do a really good job of it. And we take it very seriously. I have an amazing team that I work with. We really create a city for 5 days in the heart of New York City. So it's a big project. And we have a lot of people who are coming internationally, both visitors and exhibitors, as well as locals and people from Chicago and LA. And it's important to do it right. This is definitely a crunch time, but by now, most of the things have been set in place and we're just producing.
And you mentioned that this is the first event that you've had the full kind of year to be involved as the director, and the affair before that, the former director of the Armory was forced out due to some allegations of sexual harassment. And I just wanted to ask, I mean, that case aside, but I just wanted to ask, over the year, last year and a half, since a lot of those kind of allegations came out, have you seen an improvement in the treatment of women in art across the board, whether it be organising events or in the art world itself for artists?
I just think people feel freer to speak about issues like this now, in general, not just in the art world, but in the world, the broader world. I think that women now feel comfortable coming forward, whether it's Dr. Ford during a testimony, or, you know, just someone feeling like they can speak up in a work setting. I think that that's important for women to feel like they don't have to just sit back and take anything that they don't feel comfortable with. I'm lucky because I work in an environment with women and men who feel we have a very open communication in our office. And I feel like if anyone has any issue with anything, whatever the issue may be, that we are all very committed to sharing frustrations or upset in a respectful and professional way. So I think that it's opened the lines of communication for people, which is always a good thing.
Which artists or galleries are you excited about?
We've noticed a theme. Everyone always is interested in what's the theme for this year. Well, we have our 25th anniversary, but looking at the proposals that the galleries have put forward, there are a lot of strong solo presentations by female artists. So we've got Natalie Obadia is bringing a solo presentation by the artist Fiona Ray. And Shang Art Gallery is coming to the fair as a new exhibitor, and they have selected works by Lynn Hirschman, so that's a bit more historical. And then you have a historical presentation of Dorothea Tanning with Alison Jakes Gallery from London. So, and then some galleries are choosing to show three, like Koenig Gallery from Berlin is showing Alicia Kvade, Tatiana Truve, and Claudia Comte. So this trend to see female artists, which don't always necessarily get the profile or the exposure that male artists do, it's really refreshing to see that people are really putting an emphasis on that for this year's fair.
You came from Expo Chicago before this, which I see is also held on a pier. What makes a pier a great place to see some art?
I think that both New York and Chicago have these beautiful bodies of water next to them, the Hudson in this case, and Lake Michigan in Chicago. So the city is really building these structures that can hold, it's really the capacity. So it's great that you're getting to be on this pier, but it's less to do with that you're searching out a pier and you're really just searching out a spot that can hold, because these are very large fairs that are taking place, you know, 200,000 square feet. So that's just sheer coincidence.
An equally silly follow-up to that, I just wondered, do you have a favourite pier in the world? I mean, you're not allowed to say the one that the art show is on. I'm going to nominate Brighton Pier here in the UK, which is quite a sort of faded seaside gem. Are there any that are special to yourself?
That's so interesting. You know, I grew up in San Francisco, so the first thing that came to mind is Fisherman's Wharf, which is not at all my favorite area. I don't know that I have a favorite pier, but I do really love being by bodies of water. I've lived all over the place in the United States and a little bit in Europe at various points, and I find myself gravitating to the coast because I do love being by water. So, yeah, I'm not sure I have a favorite pier, though. I apologize.
Finally, I mean, the Armory Show, it's part of a huge art calendar that goes across the globe. I mean, what other fairs do you enjoy attending where you might see something and think, oh, that's a smart thing they're doing, and maybe you can take a spin on that for your own event? Or whether, you know, maybe you've done something at the Armory Show where you've seen it at someone else's and been like, I know where that came from.
Oh, I think everyone in all industries, and especially in the art world, you know, we look to see what other people are doing. And if it's a good idea, we might implement it in a different way in our own fairs. But when I'm traveling, I'm mainly going to connect with the community that I'm traveling to. So I'll make appointments with institutions, make sure that I get to those institutions, go to galleries in that area. I love going to a fair and discovering an artist or a gallery that I wasn't familiar with before. because I go to so many fairs, I see a lot of the same galleries and they're often showing artists I'm familiar with. But my favorite experience is to come across something that I haven't seen before or a gallery that I wasn't familiar with, because then that puts that on my radar. And it's just adding to my knowledge about the global art world and what's happening in various places. So there's not a specific fair that I love the most. It's more the experience of discovery.
That was Nicole Berry, the executive director of New York's Armory Show Art Fair, speaking to Tom Hall. The Armory Show takes place from March the 7th to the 10th. Head to thearmoryshow.com for more details. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Now, earlier in the show, we heard from world music expert Marlon Fuentes, but now it's time to catch up with a true legend of the world music scene itself, Brazilian samba maestro Seu Jorge.
Credited with spearheading a samba renaissance, Jorge became a household name with his performance in Wes Anderson's oddball classic The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou. His heartfelt reimaginings of David Bowie classics found popularity with audiences around the world, even meeting with the great man himself's approbation.
He's been revisiting the song since Bowie's death in 2016, and this week has been in Europe performing them with the backing of the Heritage Orchestra. While here, he found time to stop by Midori House. After laying down some tracks, he caught up with me to explain more about how the unlikely but wonderful pairing came to pass. In a second, we'll hear him recall how the idea first came up. But first, here's his take on the Bowie classic, Rebel Rebel.
Ei, baby, você venceu. Passe amanhã e pegue o que é seu. A maquiagem vai desmanchar. Para o seu medo aparecer. Rebel, rebel, agora eu vou. Você deu mole, então eu marco o gol. Rebel, rebel.
Yeah, so I was in my home. This is a really funny story. I was in my home. I got a day off from me. I had my day off. I used to play PlayStation. You know, I'm playing my PlayStation and my phone started ring. My ex-wife would bring the phone. The same second she got the phone, she really made a funny face. I mean, asking her what happens, and she said nothing. And then, I mean, asking again, and she said, oh, I have one guy, and I think he's American, and he's asking you about you play Pelé. I said, but I don't play soccer. I play PlayStation. I'm a good one, but soccer, I'm stupid. You know, and she knows, stupid. It's not about Pelé, the legend. It's about some character. Talk to him, but baby, I don't speak English. Yeah, I didn't speak English at the time. I'm still don't speak, you know, I'm trying communicating. And I got the phone. He said, hello, Sir George. Yeah. Hey, Sir George, you know Bowie, Dave Bowie? Yeah, he's a blonde guy. Yeah, I know him. Yeah, you know song Bowie? Yeah, I have two songs. I know two songs. It's Not America and Let's Dance, because that's a really good one. He say, hey, I love this too, but I'm talking about the classics. You know the classics? I don't know. I don't know if you know, but I'm a black guy. I'm born in Brazil, and black guys in Brazil don't listen so much rock and roll. We don't know so much, you know. He laughed a lot, and he said, okay, I cannot send a song for you because I really need you play for me a version in Portuguese. I say, okay, I see, and send a song. He sent a lot of songs. The first song I heard is The Changes. That's blew my mind because it's so beautiful music. But there's still a problem because I don't know what the style we will put inside this one. Just me and my guitar, Brazilian guitar, nylon six string. I'm trying putting some Brazilian influence inside these things, you know, more bossa nova, more calm. And he loved it and invited me to play the movie, spend 6 months in Italy and Rome, and I shot a movie with him and made all these friends, Kate Blanchett, Willem Dafoe, Bill Murray, all the nice guys, very humble guys, treat me very well. And this is the first contact, real contact with Bowie songs, but I never meet him. I expect meeting him, but when I discover he's at sick, I keep his privacy. But always I conserve the hope to see him and meet him and say thank you for every beautiful things you are done in your career. Because he's inspiring me like an actor too. He was a great actor. I remember one movie, I saw him, The Last Temptation of Christ, with Willem Dafoe and the made the Christ. He's made the Poncio Pilatus perfect. Mm-hmm. Small participation, but very intense, very big. Bowie inspired a lot of people around the world all these years and inspired me too. And I'm so glad and have so much gratitude for getting the opportunity and working with his music. I have very nice moment right now after 3 years doing the shows, meeting people around the world, his fans, fans of Wes Anderson, fans of Bill Murray, and my fans too, all together, really had hats on the audience. And yeah, I remember the last time I was here when the Royal Albert Hall, and it's so special for me, 28 years waiting for this moment for play this place. I think this is the most important place to play. When you play in a place like that, like Royal Albert Hall or Opera in Sydney or Carnegie Hall in New York, it's you graduate, you know. For Brazilian guys, it's like a graduation.
He definitely thought very highly of your covers. He's on the record as saying that you found a real new dimension of beauty in the songs that he'd written.
Yeah.
And I wondered if part of that, they change in such an elegant way in translation. And I was wondering how you came to turn them from English into Portuguese. You mentioned that you didn't speak too much English at the time. Were you working with other people? Did you kind of...
Yeah, but he gave me the freedom for doing what I want. And I decided, wrote the songs about the movie, about the characters in the movie, you know, about Ned Plimpton, Jane, and Zissou, also Wolodowski, all these guys. I read the script, I don't understand so much. I failed the movie at the same time and I made the movie. That's my goal. I got that idea. Let's talk about all these characters and putting all the into the song. Lady Stardust, for example, I made the same day I meet Miss Kate Blanchett, and she goes into the set and Wes Anderson introduced me to her. She are pregnant at this time, 4 months pregnant. She working really, really hard in the movie. And she inspired me because she showed me how much the woman is powerful. And she's so many intense and serious in his job and her job. And that made me think and wrote the song for her character. That's the way I'm choose for doing this. It's not real translated, but I try keep the titles, the songs, you know, Rebel Rebel, Life on Mars, Ziggy Stardust, all these things. I'm trying to keep it for people localize what I'm talking about, what the song is, and not just the melody. Mm. Especially because the new generation don't know well David Bowie. One time in 2006, I was in Coachella Festival, and after the my show, one the producer say, "Oh, have a lot of people want to talk to you when you sign some albums." When I go, I discover this album because Wes Anderson never told me he's putting out. It's not my idea putting out this album. When he asked me to go to the studio, when he recorded all these versions, I'm trying to keep in the same mentality when I'm shooting the movie. When I shoot the movie and when I play for him, I'm trying to play some guy, not artist. Pelado Sanz is not artist. He's not singer, professional singer. He's just one guy working at the boat and play his song for himself. You know, he's not a big singer. And I'm putting this in the same way on the studio. But when I saw the album, I said, "Oh my gosh, it's not right because he's not a good singer and not play well because I'm trying putting some amateur into this discover." The album come to Brazil before the movie, and people don't understand why I do this. People say so much bad things about the album, like give him a one star. "Oh, it's the worst album ever," something like that. Oh, because first of all, it's not well sing, well play, and the versions and the translation not right, and the people say, "What?" "What are you doing, George? You're crazy. You got the classics. You kill all the classics." Yeah, but after the movie coming in Brazil, people understand it more. It's not my idea. And even I don't know Bowie well. And this is Wes Anderson's idea. And the people go, "Oh, now I understand what happens." Mm. "Okay, George, you're okay right now." But it's really hard. And when this happened with me in Brazil about this album, I'm putting me far what happens with this album, I'd say, okay, I don't want to touch in this thing anymore, you know, like, I will keep in my life. But outside Brazil, I don't know, people love it. And especially Bowie, he say beautiful things about my covers. And when he passed away, for bad coincidence, my dad passed away 3 days later. And I decided to make this tribute to him and for my daddy too. Now I'm here, you know, after 3 years. Boy passed away, it's 3 years right now. And after 3 years, I'm still working in our Witch Orchestra. It's so beautiful when I'm playing alone, but when I get all the arrangement, the orchestra, the musicians around me, it's really special. It's very, very special moment. And the principal, because the people coming to see the show, he want to see and feel the spirit, the bow in the air. You can feel it. Always when I'm go to the stage and then play his songs, I felt him some way. I felt some protection on some covers. I feel strong. And I'm putting all my feelings inside of so much love and so much gratitude too.
Apart from, you know, your work as a musician, you've also been in two of the most important works of this century. Apart from The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, you've also been in City of God, which is this incredible portrait of the favelas, an incredible film to come out of Brazil. And I wanted to ask a bit about what you've got coming up on that side of your career, apart from touring these songs and playing with the Heritage Orchestra. What acting work are you looking forward to?
Well, now I'm busy. I have 3 movies coming out this year. And 1 series for Netflix, and then now new album too. Last week I was in Sundance Festival with Abe and a movie I'm shooting in America with Noah Snap, 1 kid from Strange Things, I play Will. I never met him before, I never see this series, but he's a great talent, nice kid. And I worked with this movie, and the movie is going very well over there. And now after Switzerland, I'm going to Berlin Festival, another movie called Mario Gala. That's a really important movie for me because I'm the principal in the movie, and especially because it is about 1 revolutionary in 64. It's a very continent movie. The premiere in Berlin, world premiere in Berlin, is really important for me and for Brazil especially because we have a very different moment in my country. So many change, so many. Brazil is different right now, and everybody waiting for the, for see what happens. And because the years in Brazil is starting after the carnival. In Brazil, we were starting after Mars, after carnival in Mars. And after carnival, because it's holidays, it's vacancy, it's a summer in Brazil, people starting working, but in general, the country are in the summer. But after carnival, everything's gonna be more busy, more harsh. We need to waiting a little bit for see what happens in Brazil, real happen with the change.
I wanted to ask about that. You know, the election of Jair Bolsonaro was a kind of surprise around the world, I think. And already I was looking at the newspaper. There's already talk about him doing these huge infrastructure projects in the Amazon, attacking these really key institutions in Brazil that have a global impact. Yeah. And I wanted to ask you a bit about how you think it's going to affect culture. Brazil has a tradition in the face of difficult governance.
Yeah.
Creatively, it responds beautifully and has done in the past. Do you think that's something that maybe we're going to see again?
Yeah, the society started organizing. It's very polarized. Right now, the opinion in Brazil, I have 2 different Brazils right now, extreme right and the left too. We need to wait a little bit for see what happens in the first years, Bolsonaro government. And he changed right now so much. He reduced the culture, he reduced the working, he reduced a lot of things because he's a liberal. He thinks liberal, he thinks in the market, he don't think on the state, but the most, in my personal opinion, the most dangerous thing is no, Bolsonaro is not prepared to be a president of Brazil, because Brazil is a big country, it's the most big country of all South America. And in my opinion, my personal opinion, Brazil needs better hands to neighborhoods like Bolivia, Uruguay, Venezuela, Argentina, Peru, Ecuador, Colombia. All these countries make strong South America. And Brazil have a condition for this. Brazil, we have so much resource for share with everybody and the people on the high level. And that's going to happen because the mentality right now is more liberal, is more about marketing. I think the president wants to be close to America, the North America. He wants to be close to Donald Trump. He agree with Donald Trump ideas. He against Venezuela. He against Cuba and the doctors in Cuba. He probably is a racist. He probably is homophobic. He's made a lot of noise. He made a lot of noise because his performance for the run, for the relationship, is scaring the world. And the streaming rights around the world is grow up so much because I think of the democracy and I don't know the words to say, but I have some doubt about democracy. Occidental see the China, Russian, grow up so fast with iron hands. I think this part of the world, the Occidental, want to be try this and put all freedom, all democracy on check. But I'm trust so much the new generation, people watching this, the world watching this. And Brazil, I think the only country, people around the world chilling for grow up, for develop is Brazil. I felt that. You know, because I'm black, I'm travel around the world, people don't look at me like a Brazilian. But when discover I'm Brazilian, people show so much love, so much interest, because no, we are the people for the expression. My people has expression. You know, the only thing has is expression. For this, we have so much good players, football, soccer players, like Neymar, Ronaldo, Ronaldinho Gaúcho, Romário, because the guys don't have a school, don't have a Sorbonne, don't have a university like you has. We have, the only thing we has is expression yourself. I got a music, what got a painting, what guys got acting, someone got sport for expression and talk about Brazil, how much we are. And Brazil is curious because nobody is half nothing. Everybody's entire Brazilian. But in Brazil has so many, many, many countries and people like Japanese, Arabic, English, Germany, French people, own people, everybody has in Brazil, but everybody is Brazilian. In Brazil, no, but Brazil, everybody is Brazilian. We need to find a way to show the world we are happy and strong and creative and peaceful. And probably the new government don't help us to show this for the world. But I think we need to wait a little bit for see what happens. Mm-hmm. Now it's just militaries on the government. Our ministry is occupied with military people. That's scary a little bit because for so long we don't have this. I know, everybody knows, Jair Bolsonaro don't know nothing about state, don't know, he don't read, he don't have a culture. He's very poor, he have a poor culture, he don't know anything, but he has democratic choose for the people. The most people choose for him, you know, we need to accept and wait a little bit and cross the finger for he doing good, but I know he's done real. Totally nothing good. And the world's watching this. The world is scared a little bit to make a trade with a country like that, country stagnate like that. We need to change. I think the people have the power for change. But now we need to wait for 4 years and see what happens.
That was Seu Jorge. And if you'd like to hear more of his take on some Bowie classics, check out The Sessions at Midori House, online now at monocle.com. You're with The Monocle Weekly. Stay tuned.
Well, thanks, Hawk, for the show. I thought it was excellent. Lots of good music, and that's what I like, good music.
It's about all you can ask for, isn't it? Lovely speaking to Marlon. I'm really looking forward to seeing who is going to walk home with one of those coveted Grammy Awards.
And I love a good award show. People complain, oh, make them shorter. No, make them longer. I love it. It's indulgent.
I can definitely take the abridged version. I'll be watching the highlights on YouTube. Yeah. And good also to hear from Georges, who is just such a charming, lovely
man. Nice man as well, right?
Really nice. We both met him, didn't we?
I'm proud of a fellow Brazilian doing so much success around the world.
Indeed. Well, we should say some thank yous. I produced the show with Tom Hall. Our studio manager today was Cassie Galpin. And we'll be back, as usual, next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Augusto Macellari.
And from me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
Bye-bye.
Ciao.